Вариант 29.
Сейчас вы будете выполнять задание по аудированию. Каждый текст прозвучит два раза. После первого и второго прослушивания у вас будет время для выполнения и проверки заданий. Все паузы включены в аудиозапись. Остановка и повторное воспроизведение аудиозаписи не предусмотрены. По окончании выполнения всего раздела «Аудирование» перенесите свои ответы в бланк ответов номер один. Задание 1. Вы услышите 6 высказываний. Установите соответствие между высказываниями каждого говорящего «AF» и утверждениями, данными в списке 1-7. Используйте каждое утверждение, обозначенное соответствующей цифрой, только один раз. В задании есть одно лишнее утверждение. Вы услышите запись дважды. Занесите свои ответы в таблицу. У вас есть 20 секунд, чтобы ознакомиться с заданием.
Now we are ready to start. Speaker A.
In 1983, at age 16, I travelled by myself to the Republic of South Africa on a Rotary exchange. Except for learning about their abhorrent apartheid racial policies, I knew very little about the country. For 4 weeks, I lived with several families, attended high schools with English and African students, and discovered that unbelievable natural and cultural beauty of the nation and its people. Over 20 years later, and I am still in touch with the friends I made on that trip.
Speaker B.
I've been travelling all over the world, but my best journey memory is about the one I had while camping in southern France in 1998. We went to France by car and found a very lovely campsite in the province of Carcaran and met friendly people and had amazing food. Once we went to the Isle of Pokerol by bike, and that isle seemed like a little piece of paradise to me. We also visited different cities like Marseille, Cassis, Toulon, Carcassonne, and many other places. We stayed for over 2 weeks and managed not to spend a fortune at all. I would recommend this trip to anyone.
Speaker C.
I've currently got over 1 million miles in my frequent flyer account. All my travels have been enjoyable from the standpoint of the places I've visited. Every place has its own unique character. Generally, coming across unexpected events or festivals has worked out well. For example, on one weekend trip to Seattle, it turned out that there was a great Salmon Days festival. In Leiden, I came across a dragon boat competition on one of the canals and had a great day there. With all the travelling over the years, it would be difficult to pick any one trip as favourite.
Speaker D.
For me, travel is associated with different annoyances. When returning to Italy after a trip to my home in Denver, there was a storm that shut down the East Coast. I was routed through San Francisco to get back to Europe. Extra travel time, but not so bad since I actually arrived home only a couple hours later than expected. There have been other times when flights were cancelled or connections missed that delayed the trip for a day, and I've even been stuck in an airport overnight once in Chicago. I've had bags not arrive with me a few times. Luckily, they always catch up in a day or two.
Speaker E.
I travelled quite a lot, but the journey I enjoyed most of all was to Brighton. I went there to study English, and I thought it would be rather boring, but it turned out to be quite funny. We studied in international groups with students from Italy, Spain, Sweden and Norway. They were all quite nice. We have lots of exciting activities like photo hunt or beach games. Of course, we went on different tours and saw English castles. All in all, I had a fantastic time and get acquainted with my best friend there. Since then, we always travel together.
Speaker F.
I'm 26 and I'm passionate about travel. This summer, I want to write a little book about my experiences and create a wish list for future trips. Actually, I've already been to quite a few places. In Italy, I was throwing coins into Trevi Fountain at night. In Austria, I saw the Olympic ski run from the steeple of a beautiful chapel. But the journey that left the most exciting impression was flying up at dawn in a hot air balloon, as I saw below the shadow of a balloon on the foothills, the Grand Canyon, and also seeing a coyote cross the road in a magenta lightning storm as I drove home at night.
You have 15 seconds to complete the task. Now, you will hear the texts again. Speaker A.
In 1983, at age 16, I travelled by myself to the Republic of South Africa on a Rotary exchange. Except for learning about their abhorrent apartheid racial policies, I knew very little about the country. For 4 weeks, I lived with several families, attended high schools with English and African students, and discovered that unbelievable natural and cultural beauty of the nation and its people. Over 20 years later, and I am still in touch with the friends I made on that trip.
Speaker B.
I've been travelling all over the world, but my best journey memory is about the one I had while camping in southern France in 1998. We went to France by car and found a very lovely campsite in the province of Carcaran and met friendly people and had amazing food. Once we went to the Isle of Poquerolles by bike and that isle seemed like a little piece of paradise to me. We also visited different cities like Marseille, Cassis, Toulon, Carcassonne and many other places. We stayed for over 2 weeks and managed not to spend a fortune at all. I would recommend this trip to anyone.
Speaker C.
I've currently got over 1,000,000 miles in my frequent flyer account. All my travels have been enjoyable from the standpoint of the places I've visited. Every place has its own unique character. Generally, coming across unexpected events or festivals has worked out well. For example, on one weekend trip to Seattle, it turned out that there was a great Salmon Days festival. In Leiden, I came across a dragon boat competition on one of the canals and had a great day there. With all the travelling over the years, it would be difficult to pick any one trip as favourite.
Speaker D.
For me, travel is associated with different annoyances. When returning to Italy after a trip to my home in Denver, there was a storm that shut down the East Coast. I was routed through San Francisco to get back to Europe. Extra travel time. But not so bad since I actually arrived home only a couple hours later than expected. There have been other times when flights were cancelled or connections missed that delayed the trip for a day, and I've even been stuck in an airport overnight once in Chicago. I've had bags not arrive with me a few times. Luckily, they always catch up in a day or two.
Speaker E.
I travelled quite a lot, but the journey I enjoyed most of all was to Brighton. I went there to study English, and I thought it would be rather boring, but it turned out to be quite funny. We studied in international groups with students from Italy, Spain, Sweden and Norway. They were all quite nice. We have lots of exciting activities like photo hunt or beach games. Of course, we went on different tours and saw English castles. All in all, I had a fantastic time and get acquainted with my best friend there. Since then, we always travel together.
Speaker F.
I'm 26 and I'm passionate about travel. This summer, I want to write a little book about my experiences and create a wish list for future trips. Actually, I've already been to quite a few places. In Italy, I was throwing coins into Trevi Fountain at night. In Austria, I saw the Olympic ski run from the steeple of a beautiful chapel. But the journey that left the most exciting impression was flying up at dawn in a hot air balloon as I saw below the shadow of a balloon on the foothills, the Grand Canyon, and also seeing a coyote cross the road in a magenta lightning storm as I drove home at night.
This is the end of the task. You now have 15 seconds to check your answers.
Задание 2. Вы услышите диалог. Определите, Какие из приведенных утверждений AG соответствуют содержанию текста? 1. True. Какие не соответствуют? 2. False. И о чем в тексте не сказано? То есть на основании текста нельзя дать ни положительного, ни отрицательного ответа. 3. Not stated. Занесите номер выбранного вами варианта ответа в таблицу. Вы услышите запись дважды. У вас есть 20 секунд, чтобы ознакомиться с заданиями.
Now we are ready to start.
My guest on today's program, What's New in Medicine, is Andrew Taylor. Andrew, welcome to the program. Now, I know there have been some pretty exciting developments recently in your area of work, and one in particular, which is close to your heart, is the smart pill.
Well, I guess smart pill is just a convenient term for what I think is going to be a pretty important development in medical technology. But what set us off looking at this in the laboratory is the fact that thousands of people each year are admitted to hospital because they have accidentally taken the wrong medicine or the wrong dose of medicine.
How come? Surely it must be quite difficult to do that.
Not really. There are people who perhaps take quite a lot of medicine, tablets and so on, particularly elderly people, and so it's not difficult for them to pick up the wrong bottle or packet without realising. And then there are people with poor eyesight, who can mistake one bottle for another. And for them, the risk of taking the wrong medicine is even higher. People are very sensitive, and they worry about getting things wrong and getting into trouble with their doctor.
I see, but it's not their fault.
Of course not. So what we've come up with is a simple system for reading pill labels out loud, and this will be of great benefit to people whose sight is not very good. We've been experimenting with the system, and generally speaking, most people are both amazed and delighted with it.
How does it work?
Well, the system consists of special labels which contain tiny microchips. The microchip contains all the important information about the medicine for that particular patient. Their name, how many to take, if it's pills, and when to take them, such as before or after meals.
What if people are still unsure about something?
Each microchip also has the name and address of their doctor, as well as a phone number, which people can ring if they have any questions.
So what is it that speaks out loud? The label?
No. It's a thing called a reader. When a patient wants to take their medicine, they press a button on a small thing called a reader. You know, the things that checkout assistants use in supermarkets, which read the barcodes, the labels on what you're buying. Well, the readers are like that. The reader sends out a radio signal to the microchip, which returns the information recorded on the label. The reader then speaks this out loud.
Don't some people find that rather scary?
A few, maybe. Admittedly, the voice is electronic, and some people are put off by new technology. But once they get used to the voice, which is quite soft, it doesn't shout at them, they become confident that they are taking the right quantity of medicine and at the right time, and that's really reassuring. And everyone agrees that without the new technology, they could end up in hospital.
You have 15 seconds to complete the task. Now, you will hear the text again.
My guest on today's program, What's New in Medicine, is Andrew Taylor. Andrew, welcome to the program. Now, I know there have been some pretty exciting developments recently in your area of work, and one in particular, which is close to your heart, is the smart pill.
Well, I guess smart pill is just a convenient term for what I think is going to be a pretty important development in medical technology. But what set us off looking at this in the laboratory is the fact that thousands of people each year are admitted to hospital because they have accidentally taken the wrong medicine or the wrong dose of medicine.
How come? Surely it must be quite difficult to do that.
Not really. There are people who perhaps take quite a lot of medicine, tablets and so on, particularly elderly people, and so it's not difficult for them to pick up the wrong bottle or packet without realizing. And then there are people with poor eyesight who can mistake one bottle for another. And for them, the risk of taking the wrong medicine is even higher. People are very sensitive, and they worry about getting things wrong and getting into trouble with their doctor.
I see, but it's not their fault.
Of course not. So what we've come up with is a simple system for reading pill labels out loud, and this will be of great benefit to people whose sight is not very good. We've been experimenting with the system, and generally speaking, most people are both amazed and delighted with it.
How does it work?
Well, the system consists of special labels which contain tiny microchips. The microchip contains all the important information about the medicine for that particular patient. Their name, how many to take, if it's pills, and when to take them, such as before or after meals.
What if people are still unsure about something?
Each microchip also has the name and address of their doctor, as well as a phone number, which people can ring if they have any questions.
So what is it that speaks out loud? The label?
No. It's a thing called a reader. When a patient wants to take their medicine, they press a button on a small thing called a reader. You know the things that checkout assistants use in supermarkets, which read the barcodes, the labels on what you're buying. Well, the readers are like that. The reader sends out a radio signal to the microchip, which returns the information recorded on the label. The reader then speaks this out loud.
Don't some people find that rather scary?
A few, maybe. Admittedly, the voice is electronic, and some people are put off by new technology. But once they get used to the voice, which is quite soft, it doesn't shout at them, they become confident that they are taking the right quantity of medicine and at the right time, and that's really reassuring. And everyone agrees that without the new technology, they could end up in hospital.
This is the end of the task. You now have 15 seconds to check your answers.
Задание 3.9. Вы услышите рассказ Аманды Хессер о своей новой книге. В заданиях 3.9 запишите в поле ответа цифру 1, 2 или 3, соответствующую выбранному вами варианту ответа. Вы услышите запись дважды. У вас есть 50 секунд, чтобы ознакомиться с заданиями.
Now we are ready to start.
It took me 6 years to complete the Essential New York Times cookbook with 4 or 5 years of recipe testing and 1 to 2 years of writing. I was basically in book hibernation for that period. I asked the New York Times for their readers' favorite recipes and got 6,000 suggestions. I tested a quarter of those and then selected the top 1,000 to include into the book. I tested every recipe because I needed to know not only that it was a great recipe and deserving of being in the book, but what was interesting about the recipe. I wanted to be able to personally recommend every recipe and be able to tell the reader what to look out for, what makes the recipes noteworthy. I wanted to be their personnel guide through the vast and wonderful archive. While working on the book, I found out that we've certainly come to like foods with lots of flavor, and more recently, you see recipes that include all the flavor elements. We tend to layer many more flavors and techniques into dishes these days. For example, we add herbs and spices, we sear meats before braising them, and we add a crisp element to a tender cake. Older recipes were more one-dimensional. That doesn't mean they're boring, but certainly there's an expectation of complexity today. The similarities are that people have always loved desserts of all kinds. Pies, bread puddings, sweetbreads, cookies, cakes, you name it. And although we've been interested in Asian foods for a long time, we're still struggling to embrace them in the home kitchen. In recent years, the influence from chefs has been terrific. I think it's allowed people to see that cooking isn't always perfect and that while there is risk, there are also ample awards. The other great thing that's happening now is that because people are curious about food of all kinds, they're becoming really knowledgeable, and this in turn is translating to the kitchen. People are becoming barbecue experts, coffee aficionados, and master bakers. Food has always been very important for people as it has held family and friends together at the table through the generations. I think the growing interest in food has brought more people in the kitchen, sharing the cooking and eating together. They may not be eating together at home, they may instead be out at a food truck or at a favorite restaurant, but they're still eating together, and they have a shared interest in eating well. This book, I hope, will serve as a monument to all the great food writers, home cooks, and chefs that have made the Times food sections a must-read for more than a century and strongly shaped the way we eat. I also hope the book will encourage people to try out dishes they haven't had before or haven't had in a few decades. I hope they'll see it as a source of both good memories and discovery. I wouldn't recommend people to use this book for academic research, as a path to losing weight, or as a doorstep. Instead, I would suggest using it for a trip down memory lane and as a gateway to culinary adventure. Failing that, put it into service as a weight for pressing terrains. Its size and weight are just right. At the moment, I'm focused on building my own website, which was inspired by my work on the book. The site has been growing quickly, and I have a lot in the works. And in January, I'm starting a new food column for the New York Times Magazine. So I'm not taking a break, as I get bored easily.
You have 15 seconds to complete the task. Now, you will hear the text again.
It took me 6 years to complete the Essential New York Times cookbook, with 4 or 5 years of recipe testing and 1 to 2 years of writing. I was basically in book hibernation for that period. I asked the New York Times for their readers' favorite recipes and got 6,000 suggestions. I tested a quarter of those and then selected the top 1,000 to include into the book. I tested every recipe because I needed to know not only that it was a great recipe and deserving of being in the book, but what was interesting about the recipe. I wanted to be able to personally recommend every recipe and be able to tell the reader what to look out for, what makes the recipes noteworthy. I wanted to be their personnel guide through the vast and wonderful archive. While working on the book, I found out that we've certainly come to like foods with lots of flavor, and more recently, you see recipes that include all the flavor elements. We tend to layer many more flavors and techniques into dishes these days. For example, we add herbs and spices, we sear meats before braising them, and we add a crisp element to a tender cake. Older recipes were more one-dimensional. That doesn't mean they're boring, but certainly, there's an expectation of complexity today. The similarities are that people have always loved desserts of all kinds. Pies, bread puddings, sweetbreads, cookies, cakes, you name it. And although we've been interested in Asian foods for a long time, we're still struggling to embrace them in the home kitchen. In recent years, the influence from chefs has been terrific. I think it's allowed people to see that cooking isn't always perfect and that while there is risk, there are also ample awards. The other great thing that's happening now is that because people are curious about food of all kinds, They're becoming really knowledgeable, and this, in turn, is translating to the kitchen. People are becoming barbecue experts, coffee aficionados, and master bakers. Food has always been very important for people, as it has held family and friends together at the table through the generations. I think the growing interest in food has brought more people in the kitchen, sharing the cooking and eating together. They may not be eating together at home. They may instead be out at a food truck or at a favorite restaurant. But they're still eating together, and they have a shared interest in eating well. This book, I hope, will serve as a monument to all the great food writers, home cooks, and chefs that have made the Times food sections a must-read for more than a century and strongly shaped the way we eat. I also hope the book will encourage people to try out dishes they haven't had before or haven't had in a few decades. I hope they'll see it as a source of both good memories and discovery. I wouldn't recommend people to use this book for academic research, as a path to losing weight, or as a doorstep. Instead, I would suggest using it for a trip down memory lane and as a gateway to culinary adventure. Failing that, put it into service as a weight for pressing terrains. Its size and weight are just right. At the moment, I'm focused on building my own website, which was inspired by my work on the book. The site has been growing quickly, and I have a lot in the works. And in January, I'm starting a new food column for the New York Times Magazine. So I'm not taking a break, as I get bored easily.
This is the end of the task. You now have 15 seconds to check your answers. This is the end of the listening test.
Время, отведенное на выполнение заданий, истекло.